This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. This year, students in Vermont schools weren't taking the yearly tests known as the NECAPs. They were taking a new set of tests to assess their learning in English and math. But this set of testing is known as the Smarter Balanced. It's designed to be more in line with Common Core curriculum, and early word on the street is that the test is much harder than in previous testing. It's also designed to be more accurate and responsive. Students take it online, and it's a more nuanced tool when it comes to pinpointing exactly what students are excelling in or struggling with. Because these tests are new, Vermont's Agency of Education said early on that the results would not count towards student or school evaluations this year. Nonetheless, the results are telling and they're worth spending some time on. And that is what we're going to do today. Education Secretary Rebecca Holcomb just announced the test results at a press conference this morning, and she joins me now. Welcome back to the program.
Such a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So before we get into the results, why did we need a new test in the first place?
Well, I think we have a new test for several reasons. The first is that we have changed standards, and we are now working towards the Common Core standards in the state of Vermont. And these standards are more challenging. They emphasize different material. They emphasize it to a different level of rigor. And so we needed a new test that would be aligned with those specific standards. We also needed a new test because we know that there are certain challenges to the pen and paper format. In particular, if it's the right level of difficulty, we can get a pretty good fix on what you know and what you don't know based on a paper and pencil test. However, the reality is in every grade, there are students who are really extraordinary in their mastery of material, and there's students who are struggling or maybe learning English and so haven't figured out how to express it. And the challenge there is we can't really tell from these pen and paper tests what these students really do know. The advantage of a computer adaptive test is it actually adjusts the difficulty of the items a little bit so that if a student is really answering every item correctly at grade level, it might pull in a couple items that are more challenging so that that student can demonstrate how much more they know and whether or not they've really mastered different concepts. And inversely, if a student is really struggling, they won't have that experience of not answering a single question correctly on the test. The test will actually pull in some items that are a little bit easier, maybe test at a slightly lower level. And in that case, the teacher can look at that data and figure out, okay, well, they didn't know these things over here, but they can actually see what the student did master. So they know where to begin instruction to help move that child forward and help them grow better.
And because basically when you're taking the test, if you're a student, or you can take a practice exam online if you're a parent or just an interested adult, but if you answer a question correctly, the test will then give you a slightly harder question going forward. And if you answer a question incorrectly, it might, as you said, give you a slightly easier question to try to figure out what's the problem here. Did you just not understand that question, or are you not understanding the material?
Right. So there's a bit of an algorithm. It's not quite that simple. So you would get a certain number of questions at grade level before it began to adjust. And I don't think the test online that you took was an adaptive test. So the operational version is adaptive, and it draws off a much, much bigger base or pool of items to be able to have that adaptive function. But you're exactly right. And actually, that's an interesting element of the test. You know, there are students for whom the NECAP tests were pretty easy, and they're used to rushing through them, handing them in, and then reading for the next 40 minutes. What's interesting about the Smarter Balance test is it's really designed to, as one person put it, test you to the point of exhaustion. It really pushes you a little bit harder to get to the place where you really are at the edge of what you know. And the reason the test is designed to do that is, if you think about it from an instructional point of view, the teachers, your next level of learning or growth is where you are really at the edge of what you already know. And so by giving a much more precise estimate of what every child actually can and can't do, it gives teachers much, much better information on where they need to teach next. And so that's the power of the test. The other thing it does is for kids with disabilities, for example, or kids who are learning English language, it has built-in accommodations so that you can look up on a dictionary a word that you might not have known. Or it has, some of the kids with disabilities, specific adaptations that allow them to still take the test independently, but to support them in their area of disability so that what we're measuring isn't their disability. What we're actually measuring is their mastery of content knowledge. And again, that's something you can't do on a pen and paper test.
And this is not a Vermont test, and it's not even a New England test. I think 18 states and one territory were taking the test this year all around the country.
Yes, and I think the change is now that we've moved to what were an effort to have a national set of standards, then we can begin to look beyond our own borders and share the cost of developing a high-quality test. This is an expensive test to develop and maintain. It's not something Vermont has the size to do by itself. So being part of that larger consortium enabled us to really have access to a better test.
How much is it costing the state? I've read that in some states it would cost upwards of $8 million to get and start administering the test.
Oh, goodness. I don't know, but I can also tell you we have a lot of federal money to support it.
So it's not something that is stressing the education budget in the state budget?
No, I would say this is actually an area where the state benefits because the state also requires us in state statute to test, and we are fulfilling that obligation through this existing test.
We're talking with Education Secretary Rebecca Holcomb, and we're learning a little bit about the Smarter Balance test. It's a new set of tests in English and language arts and in mathematics that students in grades 3 through 8 and grades 11 took this year. The results have just been released this morning, and we're going to hear more specifically about the results. Listeners, if you have a question, maybe you're a parent and you have a student who took the Smarter Balance tests this year, if you'd like to weigh in on what your kids thought of them, what you think of them, what you've been reading, or a question that you might have for Secretary Holcomb, our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your comments online on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Okay, so let's go over some of these results because, you know, that is the headline today. As I said, students in grade 3 through 8 take the tests, and then they take tests again in grade 11. And I'll just summarize the results and then we can get into what you think they mean. In math, just over half of all third graders are proficient, 52%. And it goes down from there in mathematics to a low in grade 6 and in grade 11 of 37%. So 37% of test takers in grade 11 and in grade 6 are proficient in mathematics. That's just over a third. And we start from the same place in third grade English results, 52%. As you go through the grades in English, it goes up to a high in 11th grade of 58% proficiency in English and language arts. Secretary Holcomb, tell me why these are not abysmal results.
Well, you know, it's. I have to just observe that it's funny because everyone tells us how much we're putting too much pressure on testing and we're using testing inappropriately. And then the first question they ask is, well, how did we do? You know, and I guess what I would say is let's just take a deep breath and let's stop and ask ourselves what we actually can learn from these results. And the first is that one of the things I can tell you is this is actually what we – it's actually better than what we expected. We projected how many students would score as proficient at each grade level based on the field test that was done the prior year. And in every case, these percents proficient are above those that we projected, which we don't know how to explain at this point, but our students did do better than that. As expected, many fewer students scored as proficient on this test than did on the previous test. And we expected that as well. And the first thing I'll say is that the proficiency threshold is really an arbitrary line. It's a cut score where they take all the scores that you could get at different grade levels. And the people who are making the cut scores at different grade levels don't really talk to each other. So the cut score for percent proficient in third grade, they're not making that with an eye to what the cut score is in fourth grade or fifth grade. And what they're doing is they're looking at the content of the test, and it's a group of academics, a group of practitioners, sitting down and talking about what they think kids at that grade level should be able to know and do, and then picking the items that they think kids who have that mastery should be able to answer correctly, and then sort of working from there, and that's how they figure it out. And because this test is different in a bunch of ways, we expected that cut score to be at a place that our students would experience as much more challenging. Here are a couple of the reasons. First of all, we know that the college the Common Core standards, which are new standards, were designed to measure readiness for careers in college. And the intent was deliberate to force all of us to raise our ambitions for what we thought students should be able to do when they left high school, and to make it so that our students were really challenging themselves to think creatively, think critical thinking, be able to inquire reason from evidence, engage in structured problem solving, but also ill-structured problem solving where maybe the answers weren't so clear. And that's ambitious for our schools. It is very different from what they've been doing before. So first of all, the standards are higher and more rigorous. And so we would expect to see that any test that was going to measure their performance might come back showing what would appear to be lower results. The other is that these cut scores are very ambitious. They could have been set higher. If they'd been set higher so that 70% of our students scored as proficient, everybody would have said the test was too easy. If they set them even lower, then we would have said this is ridiculous and we would have thrown the test out. So there's a political element to this as well that we just have to be mindful of, and we have to decide how we want to engage in that political conversation.
Let me stop you there and ask you a question then, because if what these tests are trying to measure is proficiency, which, you know, if you look at what proficient means, at least the way we understand it in modern parlance, like that's just sort of the basic level that people should have. So is it not actually testing proficiency?
This is not a basic level of performance. And one of the things that we did in Vermont, we offered actually to have adults take this test. And we only were able to get 3 in Vermont, so we weren't able to release the scores. But I encourage you to interview them. One was Scott Giles at VSAC, who wrote an op-ed about a week ago. But I know nationwide we've had a variety of adults take the operational form of the high school test. And I will tell you that not all of them passed. And that's worth thinking about in itself, because these are very demanding tests. And the fact that you don't score as proficient on this test doesn't mean you will not go to college, you will not be successful in college and careers. It just means that you didn't score as proficient on the test. If in order to understand what it means to actually score as not proficient, we need several years of data, and we need to be able to match that data to other outcomes outside of testing that we actually care about. So in 5 years, if we find that kids who don't score as proficient aren't able to get jobs, then we're having a very different conversation. At this point, I don't think we really know.
But the state has a waiver right now, so that these are not going to the U.S. Department of Education and being used against Vermont in terms of how our schools are assessed, but it will eventually. So, I mean, isn't that an issue then if these are too high of a bar?
Well, it's an issue anyway. I mean, and truthfully, in some ways, it isn't an issue in the state of Vermont. I mean, we've had very strong, sensible support from the State Board of Education. I mean, eternally grateful that they have been very reasonable in their expectations of the use of testing. The reason we test has to be to help kids learn more. It has to be to help teachers in the classroom have better data so that they can really think about what they're doing with kids and whether it's giving them the opportunities they need. The reason to test can't be to sanction schools because, for example, they happen to serve larger numbers of kids growing up in very adverse circumstances. Federal policy requires us to use test scores that way. We are required by federal law to test kids every year, grades 3 through 8, and again in grade 11, and report on, quote unquote, whether or not their scoring is proficient. And that's what we do. But that in itself doesn't necessarily advance. And in fact, in some ways, it may distract or make it difficult to achieve our goals. You know, 2 examples. We know, I was speaking to a teacher a couple months ago who taught in a school, and the particular kids she taught high school math to were some of the most vulnerable kids in the state. I mean, these were kids living in very, very difficult circumstances. And they came in scoring, you know, 4 grades below grade level, or some of them even more, 8 grades below grade. And they were really 4th grade math in high school. And she was a phenomenal teacher. And she'd done lots of local, you know, assessments and could see tremendous progress. But because her kids came in scoring so low, their progress will never show up on these standardized tests. That doesn't mean she's a terrible teacher. It just means that her kids came in low scoring. And that's why we have to be so careful about this proficiency conversation, because just focusing on that alone, and rather than looking at changes in the scale scores, for example, what we lose sight of is the tremendous progress some of our kids are actually making, and we lose the ability to mark that growth. And we sort of send a message, a negative message, to a lot of kids that you're not good enough, even when some of them are making tremendous progress. And if we can just figure out how to support it and reinforce it, they may end up being quite successful, going on to college, having powerful careers where they earn enough to support their families and stay in Vermont. So that's the challenge. It really is about shifting away from just focusing narrowly on proficiency levels towards using tests in a much more sensible way to support continuous growth and improvement so that every kid, no matter where they are, is just getting better. That's what we want.
We're talking again with Secretary of Education Rebecca Holcomb. And if you have a question for her, if you've been reading about the Smarter Balance tests, if you are now looking at Vermont's test results, which were just released this morning, and have a question or a thought you'd like to share, our number is 1-800-639-2211. You can also have a conversation online. Go to the Vermont Edition Facebook page and post your thoughts there. Lori is calling in from Middlebury. Hi, Lori, your thoughts.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure.
So I wanted to speak to two of the points that the commissioner has made. One was that the test is a measure of how we're teaching. And pardon me, I'm at work. And just as a scientist, I'm kind of wondering how it plays in where we spend, I think, 4 to 6 weeks changing student schedules this year in the middle school in Middlebury to practice for that test. So as a scientist, I feel like that's a little off when you're changing the experiment to measure the experiment. The other part is in terms of confidence of a student, I actually have a learner who I think was not going to benefit from being put in a situation of standardized testing, and I opted her out of the test, and I received many phone calls saying that was not an option, including from the superintendent of school. So it was interesting to me that after all of that fuss, we're not even counting these results. So I'd love to hear your comments on that.
Lori, thanks for the call. Secretary Holcomb?
Well, I think there's several questions there. And the first one, you know, there is a pretty substantial body of research on test practice, and there is some benefit to just showing kids the test so that they can orient themselves to the basic format of the test. And I think this is where you were headed. I wasn't entirely sure I understood your first question, but I think that there is no benefit to excessive practice. And what we have really tried to message and strongly support in our schools is just teaching well. If we can teach deeply and well and engage kids in rich opportunities to learn, the test scores will take care of themselves, and we don't need to perseverate on it.
So 4 to 6 weeks of switching around schedules, which is what Lori's mm-hmm. suggesting was done in the middle school in Middlebury, mm-hmm. sounds excessive to you?
Well, I'm not sure what they did, so I can't comment on the specifics. I mean, I do know that in some places they had more access or less access to technology, and schools took different solutions to trying to make sure kids had access to the test. And I think we're still working out some of the logistics around what's the most efficient and least intrusive way to do this. I think one of the challenges is when we're using testing in the kinds of high-stakes consequential ways that we are compelled to use them, they have to be very long tests because you're making decisions about whether you label a school or not. And so it has to be very, very reliable. I think that's part of the challenge. I agree with you that the goal shouldn't be excessive practicing or excessive disruption of instructional time for the purposes of testing. And the goal should be to give teachers the quality data they need in the least intrusive and least disruptive way possible. In terms of the second one, Vermont actually had the highest rate of participation in the country. I think about 97% of our students took the test. And part of that is that I think we haven't been using the test for high-stakes consequential purposes. We're not hammering our schools. What we're saying is take this test, figure out what you can in a diagnostic way, and use this test to improve your instruction. Think sensibly about it. But we don't want people spending their lives teaching narrowly to a test. We know that those situations, you know, certainly I think this test is a better approximation of some of the kinds of problem solving people will do in the real world, but it's still, you know, an artificial environment. And we know that there's so much more to learning and there's so much more to school. And we know, frankly, that testing isn't what brings our kids to the classroom excited to learn. We don't want to crowd those other valuable learning experiences out. So I'm sorry that your child felt so disrupted. And I'm sorry you felt that the test was not beneficial to your child. My hope is that in some ways that your school is using it for diagnostic purposes to think in a reasoned, intelligent, and professional, thoughtful way about what they're going to teach and how they might need to adjust what they teach. But certainly I haven't seen a lot of very test-focused instruction in Vermont. It's actually part of why I was excited to move back to Vermont, because in my children's previous school in another state, they were spending months with release forms of the prior test just doing tests over and over and over again. And as a parent myself, I know how demotivating and uninteresting and discouraging that was for my kids. So I do hear that caller's comment.
Lori said she also opted her child out of the test and got a lot of pressure about that decision. My understanding is that there are federal requirements. I think they the federal requirement ask for 95% participation of all students to be tested? So is that something that the state is feeling the pressure towards and then passing that pressure along to parents?
It actually does potentially jeopardize federal funding. And I think that's why the schools are so eager. And it also is a state requirement. It's not just a federal requirement.
We're talking today about the Smarter Balanced Assessment Test. This is the first year that Vermont students have taken the test. We just got the results today. They're not actually counting towards school evaluations this year, but we are going to learn just ahead from Secretary Holcomb what she thinks these results are good for, what we do hope to learn from them, and how schools and teachers and maybe even individual students and parents can look at these results and gain something from them. If you have a question or a thought you'd like to share, you can post it at vpr.net. Just click on Vermont Edition or call 1-800-639-2211. You're listening to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Education Secretary Rebecca Holcomb is with me today talking about the newly released results of the Smarter Balanced Assessments. Vermont students in grades 3 through 8 and grade 11 took the Smarter Balanced test this spring, and although the results aren't going to be used for official school and student evaluations, they are still valuable as a starting point for assessing how these new tests will work and where Vermont students are succeeding and where they're struggling. If you have a child who's taken the tests, what have you gleaned about how hard they were for your children? A small minority of parents around the country have decided to keep their children out of the tests over concerns about too many standardized tests. And as we've talked about before with Vermont education officials, if students don't see the value of testing like this, they don't always bother to try very hard. So we are parsing the results today with those things in mind and also learning more about how Vermont might improve upon the results that we did get in math in grade 3. 52% of students scored proficient and above. Same in English in grade 3, 52%. In math in grade 11, only 37% of students scoring proficient or above. And in English and language arts, 58%. A lot of numbers there. You can go online and find the results for yourself. And you can also ask a question if you have one for the secretary. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Linda is calling in from Central Vermont. Hi, Linda. You're on the air.
Hey, Jane. Thanks for taking my call. I have a million comments and concerns, but I'm going to keep it to the issue of the fact that these tests are administered using keyboarding, using a computer, which it seems to me penalizes kids with less great motor skills, even though they may have the other capability to answer well. It has the potential to increase mistakes. And even more importantly to me, it seems to privilege those of us who have computers in our homes with great internet access, where kids can always be on computer and be very practiced at a keyboard. And kids who don't have internet at home or don't have access to computers, and with this isn't regular old keyboarding, is not a part of their daily lives, are at a severe disadvantage.
Linda, thanks for your call. I appreciate your comments, and we'll put them to Secretary Holcomb. That's actually that question of tech savviness and technology access is one that you mentioned in the decision of the Agency of Education to not count the results this year towards school evaluation. So can you address Linda's points?
I think all of Linda's concerns are really good concerns, and they're things that we've all talked about at the Agency of Education. And in fact, one of the things we assume is part of the achievement gap that we see is familiarity with technology and access. We don't know what proportion of the difference in scores is a difference in actual math understanding, as I think Linda was alluding, or is it just facility with the platform and the technology? So I think those are really, really powerful concerns. And they're, again, an example of why in the state of Vermont, we don't feel we should be sanctioning schools and sanctioning kids right out of the gate based on these test scores, because there's so much complexity behind what a score means that unless we're really confident we know what we're measuring, it isn't fair. It just wouldn't be fair. So I think those are really, really good concerns.
But so how do you address that? Because if these tests do count next mm-hmm. year, or even if we got another waiver and they only counted, you know, 2 or 3 years from now, the question of technological access and the achievement gap and the questions of people living in poverty who don't have access mm-hmm. to technology in the same way that other people do, that's not going to be fixed within a year or two, and probably not fixable by the Agency of Education itself anyway.
But truthfully, this is the same problem we've had before. It's just wearing different clothes. Here's an example. In the summer, if you're a child in an affluent family, your parents can send you to Lego camp. They can send you to a summer camp where you do technology or computer programming. If you're a child living in very adverse situations, you may be at home alone at best with a television. You're not getting that continued support for learning throughout the summer. So when we test kids already using a pen and paper math test, we're picking up a parental difference that isn't what's happening in school. We know from research on the achievement gap that actually schools tend to hold their own during the academic year. It's the out-of-school time where that gap really does grow over time, and it gets bigger every single year. And I think that's part of the discrepancy that you see at some later grades as well. So, you know, I think that gap is always there. That's part of the structural inequality that creates the achievement gap that we see year after year. And whether it's a tech divide or whether it's access to rich opportunities to learn in broad and deep ways over the summer, It's just an opportunity gap that kids in poverty just don't have opportunities to learn that are broad and deep in the same way that other children from more privileged families have. That doesn't mean that we don't want to look at that, because I think in a state as committed to equity and as committed to making sure that every child, regardless of their zip code, has an opportunity to learn to the best of their ability, it doesn't mean we don't test. We test so we know whether or not that's there and whether or not the kinds of changes that we do make to try to narrow that gap actually are making a difference. If we opt out, if we don't take this test, then we lose credible data we can begin to use to look at the impact of various policy interventions to make a change. For example, if we all invested in extended year programming for kids who are living in really high poverty situations, we would expect that that might improve their performance. If we don't test, we wouldn't know that. We wouldn't have any way to look at that issue. So I think that that's a real concern. It's another example of why we have advocated again and again that we need to focus on trying to use these tests for very cautious and appropriate purposes and be very, very cautious in the kinds of judgments or inferences we make based on these test scores. I wanted to speak to one other point because I think you raised it. The reality is the federal government has only given us permission to not use these test scores for the current year. The reality is in Vermont currently, under No Child Left Behind, for all practical purposes, every single school in the state is now considered a low-performing school by the federal government, except for the few that piloted the Smarter Balance test in that 1 year. So we're given a pass for a year. So given that context, even if we did use the scores, it really wouldn't change our situation much. And I think what's unique about Vermont is that Vermonters are kind of moving beyond the shaming and blaming of schools and kind of moving on to, okay, what do we really want our education for our kids to be like? And what is the appropriate constructive role for testing in that context? So when I go to our schools, I feel much less anxiety and pressure around testing than I do in some of the other states I've had a chance to visit. And to me, that's a good thing. Maybe we'll lose a couple scores on the Smarter Balance assessment, but the reality is I feel like we're educating children in a robust and much more rounded way. And I'm a mother. That's what I want for my kids. I haven't yet met a parent who says all they care about is test scores.
Let's go to Gary, who's calling in from Montpelier. Hi, Gary. Go right ahead.
Hi there.
Hi.
Thanks for having me on the show. When standardized testing first started in Massachusetts, I was working at PBS, and we did documentaries following kids through the testing in that state. I had the opportunity to interview everyone from people who developed the test, the Secretary of Education, everyone. They all said that the reason that these tests were happening were to identify kids in schools that needed more support so that more money and more resources could be directed toward those students and schools. In the first place, everyone already knew what schools and students needed these more resources. The schools that face things like poverty, that face things like broken families, et cetera. Since then, the focus of tests has been not to reward schools, but to punish them. That's my first point. My second point is that I've been a curriculum developer for 20 years, and I have seen curriculum that's produced deteriorate steadily over that time, because instead of producing interesting, rewarding content that students will love, we're forced to create content using a gigantic list with checkboxes where it's more important that a kid understand the use of the semicolon than it is that they enjoy a rewarding educational environment that encourages them to pursue their interests. And finally, I wanted to say that it's not true that Vermont will lose anything if kids boycott tests, because we're already underperforming schools, and boycotting will only count as a lower test score. And trust me, the federal education department is not going to come in and take funding away from Vermont, because kids are rightfully boycotting these tests, which do them no good.
Gary, thanks for your thoughts. Let's get a response here from Secretary Holcomb.
You know, I had a surreal moment a couple months ago. One of the opportunities or responsibilities of my job is to meet with secretaries and chiefs from across the country, and was meeting with a number who were looking under the proposed new reauthorization at looking at alternative forms of assessment. And the example that they kept talking about was the Vermont Portfolio Assessment Project that we had, I think, when many people in my shoes were back in schools, you know, years ago, which at the time involved a tremendous number of teachers and developing tasks and looking at work samples and using them to talk about what would improve instruction. And what I liked about those portfolios was actually the professional conversations around how you support and provoke learning. We ended up as a state giving them up because the scoring of those portfolios wasn't sufficiently reliable to be used for consequential purposes. And there's such an irony in that to me. And you know, in that now people are looking back and praising something that we had to give up because of No Child Left Behind. And so I hear you, Gary. I think if you knew me well or heard my conversations at the agency, I think you'd know that in many ways you're singing my song. I'm very, very concerned about the adverse implications of some of the testing and the way testing is used. I do believe that there is a value in a well-designed test to support decision and just audit externally whether we're making progress, and particularly on our equity goals. I also know from my own experience as a teacher, from my research as an academic, and from my experience as a mother, that tests used inappropriately can do tremendous damage both to kids' curiosity and to their continuous growth and improvement in learning. And so I really do hear you on those fronts. And what I'm trying to encourage is us all to have a broader conversation about how we focus on important goals for all of our kids, including some of the kids who are most disadvantaged, and how we work together to achieve those, and how we work to put testing in its place as a diagnostic tool that teachers can use to prove teaching, but nothing more. I think that there's been a tremendous disservice done to public education and done in particular to children growing up in adversity by labeling them low performing year after year, which essentially blames schools or blames kids for what I think are really larger structural inequalities in the world beyond schools. So that is a huge problem that has eroded confidence in schools' ability to educate kids without actually addressing the source of the inequity, which is really seated outside the school's walls.
We've been talking a lot about students today, and we actually have a high school student on the line with us now. Gabe is calling in from Brattleboro. Hi, Gabe. What are your thoughts?
Hi,
Gabe.
I was calling because you had a caller earlier who was commenting on the fact that the tests are done on a computer and how that might put some students at a disadvantage if they don't have a lot of experience using a computer. And as a student who uses computers a lot and doesn't do as much handwriting, I just wanted to comment that I might be at a disadvantage taking a handwritten test, where I wouldn't be at such a disadvantage taking a computerized test.
Gabe, thanks for your comments. Appreciate that.
Gabe, I would be just like you. My handwriting is terrible, and I really hear you. And I think that is actually an outstanding point, because what it speaks to is the fact that any assessment privileges some people and disadvantages some others. We need to be mindful of that with every single assessment, and we need to use multiple ways of looking at student learning and come to reasoned, thoughtful, considered understandings and opinions about what actually our students can and can't do, and also what we want our students to know and be able to do. And that's such a great point to end on. Thank you.
Well, before we do end, I want to make sure we get just one point in the time that we have, because we've talked about how this test is more nuanced for students, but that also may help teachers and parents understand where students are struggling and where they're doing really well. And Kate tweeted us to say, how will the Agency of Education support teachers in interpreting this new data set and using it to guide instruction? So, I mean, that's a good point to make sure we get in here.
Yes.
How does this actually help teachers then change their instruction to help where students are not very proficient?
Well, I think one of the biggest challenges of a teacher is being able to diagnose in the moment, what is it when a student makes a mistake, what is it that led to that mistake? Is it misunderstanding? Was it carelessness? Do they have some other understanding that they didn't get? That's sort of a foundational skill. What we're hoping is the assessment will be able to break down different aspects of their understanding so that they can figure out where it is that maybe the learning broke down so that they can go back and teach those specific understandings. If you think about math and how carefully and sequentially math builds, if you miss some foundational pieces, they're going to plague you all the way through high school and beyond. And so really, hopefully the test will help teachers, and it comes with a whole set of other supports, hopefully will help them where it's needed sit down and break down where the learning isn't happening so that they can go back and teach to it. We have a series of opportunities that we're planning throughout the academic year to just take this year to try to understand the test, try to understand what it can tell us, what it can't tell us, work with our educators to try to figure out how, as professionals, we think this could or could not be a tool that helps us teach kids better. And there are also tremendous resources available through the Smarter Balance Assessment. Really, we're just at the beginning. We're just beginning to understand what this test is and how we might use it.
Well, Secretary of the Agency of Education for Vermont, Rebecca Holcomb, thank you for sharing the results and talking with us about them today.
Thank you.
Coming up, should South Burlington High School drop its nickname? Some people say Rebels has too much of an association with the Confederacy and should be retired. We'll talk about it next on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. South Burlington High School has gotten caught up in the debate over Civil War symbols and their meanings in the modern era. The school's nickname is the Rebels, and some people are questioning whether the association of the term with the Confederacy means the school should distance itself from its longstanding nickname. 7 Days reporter Molly Walsh has been reporting on the back and forth surrounding this debate, and she joins us now to explain where things stand. Molly, nice to have you on the program.
Great to be here, Jane.
Can you tell us just a little bit about the history of the Rebels nickname in South Burlington? It seems like different people are remembering it in different ways.
That's true. South Burlington High School opened in the early 60s, and shortly after the school opened, they adopted the Rebels as their nickname and mascot. Some graduates say the Rebels was never meant to be connected to the Confederacy, and that, in fact, it was students who were enamored of the movie Rebel Without a Cause, starring James Dean. One former student council member has related the origin of the nickname in that way. Others say it had something to do with the fact that South Burlington High School had a rivalry with Burlington High School to the north, and it was a play on that. However it arose, it did become associated with symbols of the Confederacy. Both students and teachers remember seeing the Confederate flag on buses, some uniforms, students waving it at times, a Captain Rebel mascot coming out on the field at football games. So however it came to be, it did become associated with the Confederacy, at least in the display of those symbols.
Well, and I guess it was about 20 years ago now the school officially retired the name as its official mascot, but did allow it to continue as the nickname of the school and the teams. Why was that decision made then?
I believe at the time it was a heated debate, and there were people who were attached to the name, didn't want to let it go, and it was a compromise decision to keep the name but move away from any images of the Confederacy. And the school has since used an interlocking SB as a kind of symbol. They say officially they have no mascot. They're emphatic about that. The administration of the school will tell you that. And they use the SB as a symbol. But you do see the word Rebels all over the campus. It's on the scoreboard. It's near the bleachers. It's on the welcome banners. It's also used in school publications and on the website. Sometimes South Burlington High School refers to itself as Rebel Land. And the school net program is RebelNet. It is a widely used nickname. There's no question about that.
Well, and this question of whether or not it should remain the nickname of the school has arisen again in the context of these conversations about the Confederate flag and about the meaning of certain Civil War symbols and words today and what they represent to different people. And this has come up, as I said, for South Burlington. So what's the school board doing about this controversy?
For now, the school board is in listening mode. It was discussed, the matter was discussed briefly at a school board meeting last week. The chair of the school board took no position. The superintendent took no position. The high school principal took no position. They all said they want to hear from the public, and they want to have a broader public discussion before making any changes. So at this point, I would say they are in listening mode. They haven't dismissed the criticisms in any way, but neither have they said they think it's time to go. I think the superintendent of schools talked about the range of views that have been expressed to him, with some people strongly saying they don't want the nickname to be changed. They feel it's really part of the school's heritage at this point, and that the criticisms are unfounded examples of political correctness that should be dismissed. Others have passed along their concerns that whatever the origin of the nickname, it was associated with symbols of the Confederacy that some people view as deeply racist, and because of that, it should go. So I think the community is in a place where there will probably be renewed discussion.
Well, just a couple seconds here left with you, Molly, but we're hearing from a lot of adults, whether they're school officials or parents who are concerned or alumni. Do you have any sense of what students at the school currently think of all this?
I think that's a question to be explored. The students are just returning to school. They're practicing sports underneath that Rebel scoreboard, and I think it is. We're hearing from some students and recent grads that they really haven't connected the nickname to symbols of the Confederacy. That in recent times, that's not something that's been on their radar. Because those symbols haven't been used, but I think it's a matter for more discussion, and I'll be reaching out to some students to find out how they feel about it.
We'll continue to watch what you say. Molly Walsh is a reporter for 7 Days. She's been explaining why some people want South Burlington High School to drop its unofficial nickname, the Rebels. Molly, thanks for your reporting, and thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
And now it's time for our mailbag, when we read your emails and comments. And I'm joined by Vermont Edition managing producer Patty Daniels. Patty.
Hello, Jane. Last week we talked about summer cooking with veggies. And afterwards, the suggestions and recipes kept rolling in. So here's one of them from Flojo, who responded to your plea, Jane, for some idea of something to do with cucumbers other than pickling them. Flojo says, juice them and freeze the juice in ice cube trays. Then add the cubes to your favorite beverage, whether it's water or gin. Basil, ginger, or lemon also sweeten the punch.
Sounds good to me. All right. Ben recommends grilled carrots for veggie meals. He says a quick blanch and a butter balsamic glaze, then throw them on the grill until they have nice char marks. You've got yourself a delicious new way to get your root veggies in the summer.
And lettuce greens took kind of a beating on our show after one listener wanted to know how to make them less bitter. One of our guests, cookbook author Maria Lisa Calta, could only offer this suggestion: don't grow them in the first place. Our other guest, Liz Ehrenberg of the Gleanery Restaurant in Putney, said drown those greens in a stronger flavor.
But some of you came to the defense of this misunderstood vegetable, and Cornwall poet Gary Margolis came out strong with a poetic ode to lettuce greens in a Vermont Edition exclusive. Here he is reading his own ode to lettuce.
Ode to lettuce. Oh, end of crisp and wilted summer. August days you don't know what to do with. This leafy head, better to make a bed for a garden's leftover overflowingness. Pale, dark green. Meant to be eaten under cover at night. Meaning to think of a leaf of it as a page to write on. Oh, to feel it on your whole wheat tongue.
Wow.
Crickets, too. Isn't that great?
Gary Margolis with Ode to Lettuce, though I'm not sure he likes it much either.
No.
Switching topics, on Wednesday, we talked with author and educator Jessica Leahy about her book, The Gift of Failure. Leahy says parents need to allow kids to fail so that they can learn to solve their own problems. And Jim wrote in with this thought, discussion has revolved around ways to accept, allow, avoid protecting our children from failure. But an even greater issue may be in holding our children responsible for failure that is their own doing. As a teacher at every level of education and as an administrator, I have encountered excuses from students and parents which deny and justify failure.
Well, if you have a reaction, a criticism, a suggestion, or any further poetry about any of our topics, you can share them with us. Connect to us on social media or email vermontedition@vpr.net. Patty, thanks.
You're welcome.
All right. A marshy pond is the perfect spot for catching frogs. You try not to splash in the water, then you scoop one into your hands and just peek between your fingers to see the little guy before he jumps away. If that scene is part of your summer or a memory from summers long past, you'll want to join us tomorrow on Vermont Edition. We'll be talking about amphibians and reptiles that hang out or hide out in the landscapes all around us. That's tomorrow at noon and 7. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening today. Thank you.